It works. Gary quietly walks to the telephone. Cheryl goes to the cellar door.
You're close, Tom said to her before he left.
She thinks of this. As the housemates busy themselves with their chores, as Mallory and Felix go to get their blindfolds, she thinks of the things Tom and Jules might return with. Is there anything they could bring? Anything that would lead to a better life for her baby? Picking up a blindfold, Mallory hopes. 33.
The river is going to split into four channels, the man told her. The one you want is the second one from the right. So you can't hug the right bank and expect to make it. It's tricky. And you're going to have to open your eyes.
Mallory is rowing.
And this is how you'll know when that time comes, the man told her. You'll hear a recording. A voice. We can't sit by the river all day. It's just too dangerous. Instead, we've got a speaker there. The recording will be playing on a loop. You'll hear it. It's loud. Clear. And when you do, that's when you'll have to open your eyes.
The pain in her shoulder comes in waves. The children, hearing her groans, offer help. In her first year alone with the children, Tom's voice came to her all the time. So many of his ideas were only spoken, never achieved. Mallory, with nothing but time on her hands, tried out many of them.
We ought to mic the yard, he once said.
Tom's idea of updating the alarm system from birds to amplifiers. Mallory, alone with two newborns, wanted those microphones. But how? How would she get her hands on microphones, amplifiers, and cords?
We can drive somewhere, Tom once said.
That's madness,
Don answered.
No, it's not. Drive slow. The streets are empty. What's the worst that can happen?
Mallory, rowing, remembers a definitive moment at the bathroom mirror. She'd seen other faces in the glass. Olympia, Tom, Shannon. All of them were pleading, telling her to leave the house, to do something more for the further safety of these kids. She was going to have to take a risk on her own. Tom and Jules weren't here to do it for her. Tom's voice back then. Always Tom's voice. In her head, in the room, in the mirror.
Make a bumper around Cheryl's Wagoneer. Paint the windows black. Don't worry about what you run into. Just go. Drive 5-6 miles an hour. You have babies in the house now, Mallory. You have to know if something is out there, if something is near. The microphones will let you know that.
Leaving the bathroom, she went to the kitchen. There she studied the map Felix, Jules, and Tom once used to plan a route to Tom's house on foot. Their notes were still on it. Felix's calculations. Using the scale, she made her own. She wanted Tom's advanced alarm system. She needed it. Yet despite her newfound determination, she still didn't know where to go. Late one evening, while the babies slept, she sat at the kitchen table and tried to remember her very first drive to the house. It had been less than a year ago. Back then, her mind was on the address from the ad. But what did she pass along the way? She tried to remember. A laundromat. That's good. What else? Storefronts were empty. It looked like a ghost town, and you were worried the people who placed the ad might no longer be there. You thought they'd either gone mad or packed up the car and driven far away. Yes. All right. What else? A bakery. Good. What else? What else? Yes. A bar. Good. What did the marquee boast? I don't know.
that's a ridiculous question. You don't remember the sadness you felt at the name of... The name of... Of what? The name of the band?
The band? You read the name of a band slated to perform on a date already 2 weeks past. What was it?
I'll never remember the name of the band.
Right, but the feeling.
I don't remember.
Yes, you do. The feeling.
I was sad. I was scared.
What'd they do there?
What?
At the bar. What'd they do there?
I don't know.
They drank. They ate.
Yes.
What else?
They danced?
They danced.
Yes.
And what? How did they dance?
I don't know.
What did they dance to?
They danced to music.
They danced to the band. Mallory brought a hand to her forehead and smiled. Right. They danced to the band. And the band needed microphones. The band needed amplifiers.
Tom's ideas lingered in the house like ghosts.
Just like we did it, Tom might say.
Just like the time Jules and I took a walk around the block. You weren't able to partake in a lot of those activities, Mallory, but you can now. Jules and I rounded up dogs and later used them to walk to my house. Think about that, Mallory.
It all kind of happened in a row. Each step allowed the next step to happen, all because we weren't stagnant. We took risks. Now you've got to do the same.
Paint the windshield black. Don had laughed when Tom suggested driving blind.
But it's exactly what she did.
Victor, he would help her. Jules once refused to let him be used like that. But Mallory had two newborns in a room down the hall. The rules were different now.
Her body still ached from the delivery.
The muscles in her back were always tight. If she moved too quickly, it felt like her groin might snap. She got exhausted easily. She never had the rest a new mother deserves.
Victor, she thought then. He will protect you.
She painted the windshield black with the paint from the cellar. She taped socks and sweaters to the inside of the glass. Using wood glue found in the garage and duct tape from the cellar, she fastened blankets and mattresses to the bumpers. All this in the street. All this blindfolded. All this while enduring the pain of being a new mother, punished, it seemed, with every movement of her body. She would have to leave them. She would have to go on her own. She would drive a quarter of a mile in the opposite direction from which she arrived. She'd turn left and go 4 miles, then a right and another 2.5. She'd have to search for the bar from there. She'd bring food for Victor. He would guide her back to the car, back to the food when she needed him to.
5 or 6 miles an hour sounded reasonable.
Safe enough? But the first time she tried it, she discovered just how hard it would be. Despite the precautions, driving without seeing was horrifying. The Wagoneer bounced violently as she ran things over she'd never be able to identify. 20 times she struck the curb. 2x she hit poles. 1x a parked car. It was pure, horrible suspense. With every click of the odometer, she expected a collision, an injury, tragedy. By the time she returned home, her nerves were shattered. She was empty-handed and unconvinced she had the mettle to try it again. But she did. She found the laundromat on the 7th try. And because she remembered it from her first drive to the house, it gave her the courage to try again. Blindfolded and scared, she entered a boot store, a coffee shop, an ice cream parlor, and a theater. She heard her shoes echoing off the marble floor of an office lobby. She'd knocked a shelf of greeting cards to the floor. Still, she failed to find the bar.
Then, on the 9th afternoon, Mallory entered an unlocked wooden door and immediately knew she had arrived. The smell of sour fruit, stale smoke, and beer was as welcome as any she'd ever known. Kneeling, she hugged Victor around the neck.
"We found it," she said.
Her body was sore. Her mind ached. Her tongue was dry. She imagined her belly as a deflated dead balloon. But she was here. She searched a long time for the wood of the bar. Banging into chairs, she knocked her elbow hard on a post. She tripped once, but a table saved her from falling to the floor. She spent a long time trying to understand equipment with her fingers. Was this the kitchen? Was this used to mix drinks? Victor tugged at her, playfully, and she turned, banging her stomach against something hard. It was the bar. Tying Victor's leash to what she believed was a steel stool, Mallory stepped behind the bar and felt for the bottles. Every movement was a reminder of how recently she'd given birth. One by one, she brought the bottles to her nose. Whiskey, something peach, something lemon, vodka, gin, and finally, rum. Just like the housemates once tried to enjoy the night Olympia arrived. It felt good in her hands, like she'd waited 1,000 years to hold it. She carried it with her around the length of the bar. Finding the stool, she sat down, brought the bottle to her mouth, and drank. The alcohol spread through her, and for a moment, it lessened the pain. In her private darkness, she understood a creature could be sitting at the bar beside her. Possibly the place was full of them. 3 per table, watching her silently, observing the broken, blindfolded woman and her seeing-eye dog. But right then, for that second, she just didn't care. "Victor," she said, "you want some? You need some?" God, it felt good. She drank again, remembering how wonderful an afternoon at a bar could be. Forget the babies, forget the house, forget everything. "Victor, it's good stuff." But the dog, she recognized, was preoccupied. He was tugging at the leash tied to the stool. Mallory drank again. Then Victor whined. "Victor, what is it?" Victor was pulling harder on the leash. He was whining, not growling. Mallory listened to him. The dog sounded too anxious. She got up, untied him, and let him lead the way. "Where are we going, Victor?" She knew he was taking her back to where they came in, by the door they had entered. They banged into tables along the way. Victor's feet slid on tiles, and Mallory bashed her shin on a chair. The smell was stronger here. The bar smell, and more. "Victor?" He'd stopped. Then he started scratching at something on the floor. "It's a mouse," Mallory thought. "There must be so many in here." She swept her shoe in an arc before it came up against something small and hard. Pulling Victor aside, she felt cautiously on the ground. She thought of the babies and how they would die without her. "What is it, Victor?" It was a ring of some kind. It felt like steel. There was a small rope. Examining it blindfolded, Mallory understood what it was. She rose. "It's the cellar door, Victor." The dog was breathing hard. "Let's leave it alone. We need to get some things here." But Victor pulled again. "Could be people down there," Mallory thought, "hiding, living down there. People who could help you raise the babies." "Hello?" she called.
but there was no response. Sweat dripped from under the blindfold. Victor's nails dug at the wood. Mallory's body felt like it might snap in half as she knelt and pulled the thing open. The smell that came up choked her, and Mallory felt the rum come back up as she vomited where she stood. "Victor," she said, heaving. "Something's rotting down there. Something..." Then she felt the true scorching sensation of fear. Not the kind that comes to a woman as she drives with a blackened windshield, but the sort of fear that hits her when she's wearing a blindfold and suddenly knows there is someone else in the room. She reached for the door, scared she might tumble into the cellar and meet with whatever was at the bottom. The stench was not old food. It was not bad booze. "Victor!" The dog was yanking her, hungry for the source of that smell. "Victor, come on!" But he continued. "This is what a grave smells like. This is death." Quickly, in agony, Mallory pulled Victor out of the room and back into the bar, then searched for a post. She found one made of wood. She tied his leash to it, knelt, and held his face in her hands, begging him to calm down. "We need to get back to the babies," she told him. "You've got to calm down." But Mallory needed calming herself. "We never determined how animals are affected. We never found out." She turned back blindly toward the hall that led to the cellar. "Victor," she said, tears welling. "What did you see down there?" The dog was still. He was breathing hard. Too hard. "Victor?" She rose and stepped away from him. "Victor, I'm just stepping over here. I'm going to look for some microphones." A part of her started dying. It felt like she was the one going mad. She thought of Jules. Jules, who loved this dog more than he loved himself. This dog was her very last link to the housemates. A torturous growl escaped him. It was a sound she'd never heard from him. Not from any dog on earth. "Victor, I'm sorry we came here. I'm so sorry." The dog moved violently, and Mallory thought he'd broken free. The wood post splintered. Victor barked. Mallory, backing up, felt something, a riser of some kind, behind her tired knees. "Victor, no, please. I'm so sorry." The dog swung his body, knocking into a table. "Oh, God. Victor, stop growling. Stop, please." But Victor couldn't stop. Mallory felt along the carpeted riser behind her. She crawled onto it, afraid to turn her back on what Victor had seen. Huddled and shaking, she listened to the dog go mad. The sound of him pissing, the sound of his teeth snapping as he bit the empty air. Mallory shrieked. She instinctively reached for a tool, a weapon, and found her hands gripping the steel of some kind of small post. Slowly, she rose, feeling along the length of the steel. Victor bit the air. He snapped again. It sounded like his teeth were cracking. At the top of the steel rod, Mallory's fingers encircled a short, oblong object. At its end, she felt something like steel netting. She gasped. She was on the stage. And she was holding what she had come for. She was holding a microphone. She heard Victor's bone pop. His fur and flesh had ripped. "Victor!" She pocketed the microphone and dropped to her knees. "Kill him," she thought. But she couldn't. Maniacally, she searched the stage. Behind her, it sounded like Victor had chewed through his own leg. "Your body is broken. Victor is dying, but there are two babies in boxes at home. They need you, Mallory. They need you. They need you. They need you."
Tears saturated and then spilled out through her blindfold. Her breath came in gasping heaves. On her knees, she followed a wire to a small square object at the far end of the stage. She discovered three more cords, leading to three more microphones. Victor made a sound no dog should make. He sounded almost human in his despair. Mallory gathered everything she could. The amplifiers, small enough to carry, the microphones, the cords, a stand.
"I'm sorry, Victor. I'm so sorry, Victor. I'm sorry."
When she rose, she thought her body couldn't take it. She believed that if she had 1 ounce less of strength, she'd fall down forever. Yet she stood. As Victor continued to struggle, Mallory felt her way with her back against the wall. At last, she stepped down from the stage. Victor saw something. Where was it now? There was no stopping the tears. Yet a stronger feeling took over. A precious calm. Motherhood. As if she were a stranger to herself, operating for the babies alone. Crossing the bar, she came close enough to Victor to feel some part of him rub against her leg. Was it his side? His snout? Was he saying goodbye? Or had he thrown her his tongue? Continuing through the bar, Mallory made it back to where they'd come in. The open cellar door was near, but she didn't know where. "Stay away from me! Stay away from me!" Struggling to carry the gear, Mallory stepped once and felt no ground beneath her shoe. She lost her balance. She almost fell, and she righted herself. Her voice sounded like a stranger's as she screamed before exiting the bar. The sun was hot against her skin. She moved quickly, back toward the car. Her thoughts were electric. Events were happening too fast. She slipped off the concrete curb and smacked hard into the car. Frantic, she loaded the things in the back hurriedly. When she got behind the wheel, she wailed. The cruelty. This world. Victor. She had the key in the ignition and was about to turn it. Then, her black hair wet with sweat, she paused. What were the chances something had gotten into the car? What were the chances something was seated beside her in the passenger seat? If something had, she'd be delivering it to the children. "To get home," she told herself. Even the voice in her mind quivered. Even the voice in her mind sounded like it was crying. "You absolutely have to look at the odometer." She flailed blindly about the car, her arms smacking the dashboard wildly, hitting the roof, thrashing against the windows. She tore her blindfold off. She saw the black windshield. She was alone in the car. Using the odometer, she drove the same 2.5 miles back, then 4 to Shillingham, then a quarter mile more to home, hitting every curb and sign on the way. Only 5 miles an hour. It felt like eternity. After parking, she gathered what she'd found. Inside, the door secure behind her, she opened her eyes and rushed to the baby's bedroom. They were awake, red-faced, crying, hungry. Much later, she lay awake, shaking on the dank kitchen floor, staring at the microphones and two small amplifiers beside her, remembering the sounds Victor made. Dogs are not immune. Dogs can go mad. Dogs are not immune. And whenever she thought she was going to stop crying, she started again. 34. Mallory is in the upstairs bathroom. It is late, and the house is silent. The housemates are sleeping. She is thinking of Gary's briefcase.
Tom told her to be more of a leader in his absence. But the briefcase is bothering her. Just like Don's sudden interest in Gary bothers her. Just like everything Gary says in his grandiose, artificial way. Snooping is wrong. When people are forced to live together, their privacy is essential. But isn't this her duty? In Tom's absence, isn't it up to her to find out if her feelings are right? Mallory turns her ear to the hall. There is no movement in the house. Exiting the bathroom, she turns toward Cheryl's room and sees the shape of her body, resting. Peering into Olympia's room, she hears her softly snoring. Quietly, Mallory descends the stairs, her hand on the railing. She goes to the kitchen and turns the light on over the stove. It is dim and hums softly. But it's enough. Entering the living room, Mallory sees Victor's eyes looking back at her. Felix is asleep on the couch. The space on the floor, usually occupied by Tom, is vacant. Passing through the kitchen, she approaches the dining room. The stove's muted light reaches just far enough so that she can see Gary's body lying on the floor. He's on his back, asleep. She thinks. The briefcase leans against the wall, within arm's reach of his body. Softly, Mallory treads across the dining room. Floorboards creak under her weight. She stops and stares intently at his bearded, gaping mouth. He wheezes a bit, steady and slow. Holding her breath, she takes a final step toward him and stops. Hovering above him, she watches closely without moving. She kneels. Gary snorts. Her heart flutters. She waits. To get the briefcase, she must reach across his chest. Her arm dangles inches from his shirt as he slumbers. Her fingers grasp the handle when he snorts again. She turns. He is staring at her. Mallory freezes. She scans both of his eyes. She exhales softly. His eyes are not open. Shadows fooled her. Slowly, she lifts the briefcase, rises, and leaves the room. At the cellar door, she stops and listens. She hears no movement from the dining room. The cellar door opens quietly and slowly, but she can't help the whine of the hinges. It sounds louder than it usually does, as if the whole house is slowly creaking open. And with just enough room to enter, she slips inside. The house is silent again. She slowly descends the stairs down to the dirt floor. She's nervous. It takes her too long to find the string for the light bulb. When she does, the room gushes with bright yellow light. Too bright. It might wake Cheryl, sleeping two floors above. Glancing around the room, she waits. She can hear her own labored breathing. Nothing else. Her body aches. She needs to rest. But right now, she wants only to see what Gary brought with him. Stepping to the wooden stool, she sits. She clicks open the briefcase. Inside, she sees a worn toothbrush, socks, t-shirts, a dress shirt, deodorant, and papers, a notebook. Mallory looks to the cellar door. She listens for footsteps. There are none. She pulls the notebook out from under the clothes and sets the briefcase on the ground. The notebook has a clean blue cover. The edges are not bent. It's as if Gary has kept it, preserved it, in the best condition he could. She opens it and reads. The handwriting is so exact that it frightens her. It's meticulously crafted. Whoever wrote it did so with passion, with pride. As she flips through the pages, she sees some sentences are written traditionally, from left to right. Others are written in the opposite direction from right to left. Still others, deeper into the notebook, begin at the top of the page and walk down. By the end, the sentences spiral neatly, still perfectly crafted, creating odd designs and patterns made of words. To know the ceiling of a man's mind is to know the full power of these creatures. If it's a matter of comprehension, then surely the results of any encounter with them must differ greatly between two men. My ceiling is different from yours, much different from the monkeys in this house. The others, engulfed as they are in hyperbolic hysteria, are more susceptible to the rules we've ascribed the creatures. In other words, these simpletons with their childish intellects will not survive, but someone like myself, well, I've already proven my point. Mallory flips the page. What kind of a man cowers when the end of the world comes, when his brothers are killing themselves, when the streets of suburban America are infested with murder? What kind of man hides behind blankets and blindfolds? The answer is most men. They were told they would go mad, so they go mad. Mallory looks to the cellar stairs. The light from the stove shows through the thin slit at the bottom of the cellar door. She thinks she should have turned it off. She thinks about doing it now. Then she flips the page. We do it to ourselves, we do it to ourselves, we do it to ourselves. In other words, make note of this. Man is the creature he fears. It's Frank's notebook. But why does Gary have it? Because he wrote it, of course. Because, Mallory knows, Frank didn't tear down the drapes at Gary's old place. Gary did. Mallory stands, her heart racing. Tom isn't home. Tom is on a 3-mile walk to his house. She stares at the foot of the cellar door. Light from the stove. She expects shoes to suddenly obscure it. She looks to the shelves for a weapon. If he comes, what can she kill him with? But no shoes obscure the light, and Mallory brings the notebook closer to her face. She reads. Rationally speaking, and in the interest of proving this to them, I've no choice. I will write this 1,000 times until I convince myself to do it. 2,000. 3. These men deny discourse. Only proof will change them. But how to prove it to them? How to make them believe? I will remove the drapes and unlock the doors. In the margins, there are numbered notes and corresponding numbers are written painstakingly across the top. Here is note 2,343. Here is 2,344. Ceaseless. Endless. Brutal. Mallory turns the page. A noise comes from upstairs. She looks to the door. She is afraid to blink, to move. She waits and stares. Her eyes on the door, she reaches for the briefcase and slips the notebook back under Gary's things. Is it facing the right way? Was this how he had it? She doesn't know. She doesn't know. She closes the briefcase and pulls the light bulb string. Mallory closes her eyes and feels the cool earth beneath her feet. She opens her eyes. Absolute darkness is cut only by the stove light from under the cellar door. Mallory watches it, waiting. She crosses the cellar, her eyes adjusting to the darkness as she climbs the stairs carefully and presses her ear against the door. She listens, breathing erratically.
The house is silent once again. Gary is standing at the other end of the kitchen. He is watching the cellar door. When you open it, he will greet you.
She waits and waits and hears nothing. She opens the door. The hinge creaks. Briefcase in hand, Mallory's eyes dart into the kitchen.
The silence is too loud.
But nobody is there. No one is waiting for her.
Hand on her belly, she squeezes herself through the doorframe and shuts the door behind her. She looks to the living room, to the dining room, to the living room, to the dining room. On the tips of her toes, she passes through the kitchen and enters the dining room at last. Gary is still on his back. His chest rises and falls. He groans softly. She approaches. He moves. She waits. He moved. It was only his arm. Mallory watches him, staring at his face, his unopened eyes. Hastily, she kneels over his body, inches from his skin, and places the briefcase back against the wall.
Is this the way it was facing?
She leaves it. Standing, she rushes out of the room. In the kitchen, in the glow of the light, someone's eyes meet hers.
Mallory freezes. It's Olympia.
What are you doing?
Olympia whispers.
Nothing,
she says breathlessly. Thought I left something in there.
I had a terrible dream,
Olympia says. Mallory is walking toward her, reaching for her. She leads Olympia back upstairs. They take them together. At the top, Mallory looks back down at the staircase.
I have to tell Tom, she says.
About my dream? Mallory looks at Olympia and shakes her head. No, no, I'm sorry. No.
Mallory?
Yes.
Are you okay?
Olympia, I need Tom.
Well, he's gone.
Mallory stares at the foot of the stairs. The stove light is still on. Enough of it splashes across the living room's entrance that if someone were to enter the kitchen from the dining room, she'd be able to see their shadow. She is staring fervently into the dim room, waiting for the shadow, certain it's coming. As she watches, she thinks of what Olympia just said. Tom is gone. She thinks of the house as one big box. She wants out of this box. Tom and Jules outside are still in this box. The entire globe is shut in. The world is confined to the same cardboard box that houses the birds outside. Mallory understands that Tom is looking for a way to open the lid. He's looking for a way out. But she wonders if there's not a second lid above this one, then a third above that.
Boxed in,
she thinks.
Forever.
35. It has been a week since Tom and Jules left for the 3-mile walk with the Huskies. More than anything, right now, Mallory wants them home. She wants to hear a knock at the door and to feel the relief of having them back again. She wants to hear what they encountered and see what they've brought back. She wants to tell Tom what she read in the cellar. She did not go back to sleep last night. In the darkness of her bedroom, she thought only about Gary's notebook. She is in the foyer now. Hiding, it seems, from the rest of the house. She can't tell Felix. He might do something. He would say something. Mallory wants Tom and Jules here in case he does. Felix would need them. Who knows what Gary is capable of doing?
what he's done. She can't talk to Cheryl. Cheryl is fiery and strong. She gets angry. She would do something before Felix would. Olympia would only be more scared. She can't talk to Gary. She won't, not without Tom. But despite the change in his affiliation, despite his unpredictable moods, Mallory thinks maybe she can talk to Don. There is a goodness in him, she thinks. There always has been. Gary has been the devil on Don's shoulder for weeks. Don needed someone like this in the house, someone who sees the world more like him. But couldn't Don's skepticism prove to be helpful here? Hasn't he thought, in all his talks with Gary, that something might be wrong with the newcomer? Gary sleeps with the briefcase within arm's reach. He cares about it. Cares about and believes the writings inside. Everything in this new world is harsh, she thinks. But nothing so much as her discovering Gary's notebook while Tom is away.
He could be away for a long time.
Stop it. Forever. Stop it. He could be dead. They could have been killed in the street right outside. The man you're waiting for could be dead a week, just a lawn away. He's not. He'll return. Maybe. He will. Maybe.
They mapped it out with Felix.
What does Felix know? They all did it together. Tom wouldn't risk it unless he knew he had a chance to make it. Remember the video George watched? Tom is a lot like George.
Stop!
He is. He idolized the man. And what about the dogs? We don't know that dogs are affected. No, but they could be. Can you imagine what it would be like? A dog going stark mad?
Please,
no. Necessary thoughts. Necessary visions. Tom might not come back.
He will, he will, he will.
And if he doesn't, you'll have to tell someone else.
Tom's coming back.
It's been a week.
He's coming back.
You can't tell Gary. Talk to someone else first.
Don.
No. No, not him. Felix. Don will kill you.
What?
Don has changed, Mallory. He's different. Don't be so naive. He wouldn't hurt us.
Yes, he would.
He'd take the garden axe to you all.
Stop!
He doesn't care about life. He told you to blind your baby, Mallory.
He wouldn't hurt us.
He would. Talk to Felix.
Felix will tell everyone.
Tell him not to. Talk to Felix. Tom may not come back. Mallory leaves the foyer. Cheryl and Gary are in the kitchen. Gary is at the table, sitting, scooping pears from a can.
Good afternoon,
he says, in that way he has of making it sound like he's responsible for the good afternoon. Mallory thinks he can tell. She thinks he knows.
He was awake, he was awake, he was awake. Good afternoon,
she says. She walks into the living room, leaving him. Felix is sitting by the phone in the living room. The map is open on the end table.
I don't understand,
he says, confused. Felix does not look well. He hasn't been eating as much. The assurances he gave Mallory a week ago no longer exist.
It's such a long time, Mallory. I know Tom would know what to do out there, but it's such a long time.
You need to think about something else, Cheryl says, peering her head around the corner. Seriously, Felix, think about something else, or just go outside without a blindfold. Either way, you're driving yourself mad. Felix exhales loudly and runs his fingers through his hair. She can't tell Felix. He's losing something. He's lost something. His eyes are dull. He's losing sensibility, thought.
strength. Without a word, Mallory leaves him. She passes Don in the hall. The words, what she's discovered, come to life within her. She almost speaks. Don, Gary is no good. He's dangerous. He has Frank's notebook in his briefcase.
What, Mallory?
Just what I said.
You were snooping, going through Gary's things?
Yes.
Why are you coming to me with this?
Don, I just need to tell someone. You understand that, don't you?
Why didn't you just ask Gary? Hey, Gary.
No.
She can't tell Don. Don has lost something, too. He might get violent. Gary could, too.
One shove, she thinks, and you lose the baby.
She imagines Gary at the top of the cellar stairs, her broken, bleeding body crumpled at the bottom. You like reading in the cellar, do you? Then die down there with your child.
Behind her, she hears all the housemates are in the living room. Cheryl is talking to Felix. Gary is talking to Don. Mallory turns toward their voices and approaches the living room. She is going to tell them all. When she enters the room, her body feels like it's made of ice, melting, like pieces of herself fall away and sink under the unbearable pressure of what's to come. Cheryl and Olympia are on the couch. Felix waits by the phone. Don is in the easy chair. Gary stands, facing the blanketed windows. As she opens her mouth, Gary slowly looks over his shoulder and meets her eyes.
Mallory, he says sharply, is something on your mind?
Suddenly, clearly, Mallory realizes that everyone is staring at her, waiting for her to speak. Yes, Gary, she says. There is.
What is it?
Don asks. The words are stuck in her throat. They climb up like the legs of a millipede, reaching for her lips, looking to get out at last. Does anyone remember Gary's... She stops. She and the housemates turn toward the blankets. The birds are cooing.
It's Tom, Felix says desperately. It must be.
Gary looks into Mallory's eyes again.
There is a knock at the front door.
The housemates move fast. Felix rushes to the front door. Mallory and Gary remain. He knows, he knows, he knows, he knows, he knows. When Tom calls out, Mallory is trembling with fear. He knows.
Then, having heard Tom's voice, Gary leaves her and heads to the foyer.
Once the questions have been asked and the housemates have their eyes closed, Mallory hears the front door open. The cool air rushes in, and with it the reality of how close Mallory just came to confronting Gary without Tom in the house. Dogs paw on the foyer tile. Boots. Something smacks against the doorframe. The front door closes quickly. There's the sound of the broomsticks scratching the walls. Tom speaks, and his voice is deliverance.
My plan was to call you guys from my house, but the fucking phone was out.
Tom, Felix says, manic but weak.
I knew you guys would do it. I knew it.
When Mallory opens her eyes, she doesn't think about Gary. She doesn't see the perfectly manicured letters that wait in his briefcase. She sees only that Tom and Jules are home again.
We raided a grocery store,
Tom says. The words sound impossible.
Someone had been there before, but we got a lot of good stuff.
He looks tired, but he looks good.
The dogs worked, he says. They let us.
He is proud and happy.
But I got something from my house that I hope will help us even more.
Felix helps him with his duffel bag. Tom unzips it and removes something.
Then he lets it fall to the foyer floor. It's a phone book.
We're going to call every number in here, he says. Every single one, and somebody is going to answer.
It's only a phone book, but Tom has turned it into a beacon.
Now, Tom says, let's eat.
The others excitedly prepare the dining room. Olympia gets the utensils. Felix fills glasses with water from the buckets. Tom is back. Jules is back.
Mallory, Olympia calls. It's canned crab meat.
Mallory, caught somewhere between two worlds, enters the kitchen and begins helping with dinner. 36. Someone is following them. There is no use asking herself how much farther they have to go. She doesn't know when she will hear the recorded voice that tells her she's arrived. She doesn't know if it still exists. Now she only paddles. She only perseveres. An hour ago, they passed what sounded like lions engaged in battle. There were roars. Birds of prey screech threats from the sky. Things growl and snort from the woods. The river's current is moving faster. She remembers the tent Tom and Jules found in the street outside their house. Could there be something like that, so astonishingly out of place, here on the river? Could they crash into it now? Out here, she knows, anything imagined is possible. But right now, it is something much more concrete that worries her. Someone is following them. Yes, the boy heard it too. A phantom echo. A second rowing in step with her own. Who would do it? And if they meant to harm her and the children, why didn't they do it when she was passed out? Is someone escaping their home as well? Boy, she says quietly, tell me what you can about them. The boy is listening. I don't know, Mommy. He sounds ashamed. Are they still there? I don't know. Listen. Mallory considers stopping, turning, facing the noise she hears behind them. The recording will be playing on a loop. You'll hear it. It's loud, clear. And when you do, that's when you'll have to open your eyes. What follows them? Boy, she says again, tell me what you can about them. Mallory stops rowing. Water rushes around them. I don't know what it is, he says. Still, Mallory waits. A dog barks from the right bank. A second bark answers. Wild dogs, Mallory thinks. More wolves. She begins paddling again. She asks the boy again what he hears.
I'm sorry, Mommy,
he yells. His voice is cracked with tears, shame. He doesn't know. It's been years since the boy wasn't able to identify a sound. What he hears is something he's never heard before. But Mallory believes he can still help. How far away are they? Mallory asks. But the boy is crying.
I can't do it.
Keep your voice down, she hisses. Something grunts from the left bank. It sounds like a pig. Then another one. And another. The river feels too thin. The banks too close. Does something follow them? Mallory rows. 37. For the first time since arriving at the house, Mallory knows something the others don't. Tom and Jules have just returned. As the housemates prepared dinner, Tom brought the new stock of canned goods to the cellar. Mallory met him down there.
Maybe Gary kept the notebook because he wanted to study Frank's writing, or maybe he wrote it himself. But Tom needed to know. Now. In the cellar light, he looked tired but triumphant. His fair hair was dirty. His features looked more aged than the first time she was down here with him. He was losing weight. Methodically, he removed cans from his and Jules's duffel bags and set them on the shelves. He began talking about what it was like inside the grocery store, the stench of so much rotten food, when Mallory found her opportunity. But just when she did, the cellar door opened. It was Gary.
"I'd like to help you if I can," he said to Tom from the top of the stairs.
"All right," Tom said. "Come on down, then."
Mallory exited as Gary reached the dirt floor. Now everybody is seated at the dining room table, and Mallory is still looking for her opportunity. Tom and Jules describe their week slowly. The facts are incredible, but Mallory's mind is fixed on Gary. She tries to act normal. She listens to what they say. Each minute that passes is another in which Tom doesn't know that Gary may be a threat to the rest of them. It almost feels like she and the others are intruding on Gary's space. Like Gary and Don had the decency to invite them into their dining room, their favorite place for exchanging whispered words. The two have spent so much time in here that it smells of them. Would they have joined the group if dinner was served in the living room? Mallory doesn't think so. As Tom describes walking 3 miles blindfolded, Gary is affable, talkative, and inquisitive. And every time he opens his mouth, Mallory wants to yell at him to stop. "Come clean first," she wants to say. But she waits.
"Would you say, then," Gary says, his mouth full of crab, "that you are now convinced animals are not affected?"
"No, I wouldn't say that," Tom says. "Not yet. Maybe we just didn't pass anything for them to see."
"That's unlikely," Gary says.
Mallory almost screams it. Tom then announces he has another surprise for everyone.
"Your duffel bag is a veritable clown car," Gary says, smiling.
When Tom returns, he's carrying a small brown box. From it, he pulls forth 8 bicycle horns.
"We got these at the grocery store," he says, "in the toy aisle."
He hands them out.
"Mine has my name on it," Olympia says.
"They all do," Tom says. "I wrote them, blindfolded, with a Sharpie."
"What are they for?" Felix asks.
"We're inching toward a life of spending more time outside," Tom answers, sitting down. "We can signal one another with these."
Suddenly, Gary honks his horn. It sounds like a goose. Then it sounds like geese, as everyone honks their horns chaotically. The circles under Felix's eyes stretch as he smiles.
"And this," Tom says, "is the grand finale."
He reaches into his duffel bag and pulls forth a bottle. It's rum.
"Tom," Olympia says.
"It's the real reason I wanted to go back to my house," he jokes.
Mallory, listening to the housemates laugh, seeing their smiling faces, can stand it no longer. She stands up and slams her palms on the table.
"I looked through Gary's briefcase," she says. "I found the notebook he told us about, the one about tearing the blankets down, the one he said Frank took with him."
The room goes silent. Every housemate is looking at her. Her cheeks are red with heat. Sweat prickles her hairline. Tom, still holding the bottle of rum, studies Mallory's face. Then he slowly turns to Gary.
"Gary?"
Gary looks to the tabletop.
"He's buying time,"
Mallory thinks. The fucker is buying time to think.
Well...